Today, we have the second part of a journey that began yesterday. Jason Cook is our guide. He's a student, slogging his way through the THM like many of you. He's also an architect. He lives in Tyler with his wife, Amber, who is a doctor and canceled all of her appointments with all of her patients so she could be with us today. Their two little girls are with us as well. After chapel, I heard one of them say yesterday, "Daddy was preaching." Jason's mom, Mary, has also joined us from Katy, Texas. Can y'all wave and see y'all? God's been convincing Jason this last year that in addition to all those other things, he's also a poet. Part of his response has been thinking deeply about what listening is and how listening works. When we asked him to share with DTS what he's been learning, he decided not to write you an academic paper and deliver that, but to tell you a story. In the first part yesterday, we went back in time to when Jason was in college at Rice University, and he ended up preaching at a poetry slam. But he was just beginning to learn how to listen well. Today, we're going to continue that journey. The setting is DTS. The story uses a bit of what in literary terms is known as magical realism to invite us into his journey of learning how to listen well. First, though, I'd like to share a few thoughts on listening since I have the mic. Sorry about that. Knowledge puffs up. And at any institution of higher education, especially one as rigorous as DTS, it's hard not to become a blowfish. But love builds up. The key to any relationship is communication. That's one reason I like that my department is in the Ministry and Communication Division at DTS. But this idea of communication also presents a challenge for the arts, because we tend to think of communication like this. There's an idea over here, there's an audience over here, and communication is an arrow that moves the idea from here to the audience. It gets the idea from here to here. But that's not a definition of communication any therapist would use, is it? Communication in relationships is primarily about learning how to listen well, how to be on the receiving end of the arrow, to go between. And it is by receiving, by listening, by truly hearing the other person that we earn the respect to be able to speak something back. Mission theory used to operate with the assumption of that first arrow. We have the truth over here, and we need to figure out how to communicate it to get it over there. In the last 30 or so years, though, missions theory has shifted. Missionaries begin by recognizing the places God is already present and active. Missionaries start by being on the receiving end of the arrow. Rather than being called just givers of truth, they might better be called witnesses of truth. I believe we need a similar shift in how we approach our culture around us. Too often we want to tell our culture the truths we've learned, but we don't really know how to listen well to the truths that are already present in people's lives. The arts can help us with this task. Truths of mystery have a way of slipping out in the arts. And so we hear a non-Christian poet say something like, "In him we live and move and have our being." And with the Apostle Paul, we can reply, "Yes, yes." That's actually a perfect way to put it. Practicing art, practicing watching or listening or doing art, helps train us in how to listen well. It teaches us how to hear both the cries of our fellow humans and the activity of God outside of our churches. As we learn to listen well, we begin to develop deeper and more profound relationships. So I invite you today, sit back, take a deep breath, and receive this gift. And in receiving, we will continue our journey of learning how to listen well to God's ongoing activity all around us.
Once upon a time, not so very long ago, and not so very far away, there lived a poet in the woods. The curious thing about this poet is that he did not write poetry. Instead, he spent his days making drawings of buildings that did not exist and hoping that one day they would. He spent his evenings talking with his wife about all the strange and wonderful places they hoped to visit someday. And at night, he went on long walks beside the lake, listening to the nightly chorus of crickets and bullfrogs and whispering leaves. But he did not write poetry. No, instead, the busyness of his daily routine filled up so much of his mind that he nearly forgot he was a poet. But one day, as he was walking beside the lake, he began to wonder if he might ever have a chance to leave these woods and go on an adventure. He didn't want to go too far away or stay away too long. But he wondered out loud, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to go someplace new, to visit someplace strange and wonderful? And just when he had that thought, another thought came floating on the breeze. It was only a whisper of a thought, not even a complete thought, just three quiet letters burning in his imagination like a purple flame. And so begins an adventure, wonderful and strange. And actually, this adventure is my adventure, and this story is my story, because I'm the poet who lives in the woods. And at times, some of this story may seem hard to believe, but nevertheless, this is what happened to me. It begins on a day when the heavens opened wide and the skies cried with rage. The dark clouds looked down upon me, and I knew as I left my home in the woods, I'd be late for my first day of class. The rain blew sideways like shards of glass, but a faint light glowed ever before me. Come, it beckoned, and I came. I traveled for hours, quietly pondering. What would await me? What would I see? Or maybe I should just turn around and go home. But the blinding rage of the skies started waning. Softer and softer, the rain abated, and there before me, I saw a village, a quiet village of tan-bricked buildings and myrtle trees in pink bloom. And out before me stretched a great green lawn, drinking the gentle rain. And in the middle of the lawn, I saw a statue cast in bronze of a god kneeling down to wash the feet of a man. How strange. Under the weeping skies, it seemed like the man was crying, and the god cried too. I wondered what would cause such tears. suddenly remembered. I was late for my class. I ran through the grass to this three-story building, but stopped short before two foreboding doors and shuddered. What manner of place is this? As I looked, the doors creaked open slowly, and the building exhaled a whispered warning, "Tremble all who enter here." What manner of place is this? And that's when I noticed my solitude. Not a soul, not a breath, not a voice to be heard, no sound but my own soft tread. But I entered anyway. I wandered the hallways, stopping at each door, peering through windows into each room, searching, but never finding a reason to enter. So I walked up a flight of steps to the second floor and stopped at more doors and peered through more windows. And there, in the last room, a reason, a whiteboard covered in symbols drawn by hand, a code, a script. I had seen such symbols before, but I could not understand them. So I walked to the board and with a trembling hand, traced each delicate mark, wondering what secrets they hid. At a table nearby, there was a large blue book with the same symbols on the cover. So I opened and turned the well-worn pages and paused at a page that explained the letters, how to form them into living words, and with an untrained tongue, I spoke aloud. Alpha, beta, gamma. But I stopped feeling uneasy because as I spoke, I sensed another voice in concert with my own. I shivered and lifted my eyes, and there stood a man with curly gray hair and a gray beard streaked with white. His glasses sat low on his nose, and he smiled. He looked at me and saw my confusion and said, "You cannot learn to speak without listening." So he recited the rest of the alphabet and then something else that I could not understand. And then he looked at me again and said, "What manner of place is this? What secrets are hidden here?" My face distorted with wonder and fear. How did he know my secret thoughts? Then he nudged his glasses up his nose and grinned this playful grin and said, "Aren't you the poet who lives in the woods?" I wondered how he knew me, but I turned away. My face burned with shame. I said, "I cannot claim that title. Poets write poetry. I don't write anything worthy of the name." And still looking down, I continued. I said, I used to write poetry. I loved to write poetry. I loved poetic words, but that was long ago. I don't know. But I wouldn't call myself a poet. And then the professor, for that is what he seemed, looked at me and said, "You want to know what kind of place this is?" It's wonderful and strange. It's the kind of place that reminds you who you are. It teaches you to listen to the whispers of your heart. And as he spoke, the tempo of my heart was rising, racing, and the shame began to fade, and curiosity was urging me. So I said, "Professor, a moment ago you said something in a language that I didn't understand. What did you say? What did it mean?" He looked at me and said, "Something I once read in a leather-bound book." And then he smiled and said, "What are you seeking?" Then he turned and walked toward the door. "Wait," I shouted, "where are you going?" And looking back, he said, "Come, and you will see." Then he left the room without another word, but his words still lingered in my soul. What am I seeking? And what would he show me? I raced to the door just in time to see him entering the stairwell, and I followed. But the moment that I entered after him, the lights went out. Everything was black and silent, except the tap, tap, tapping of his unhurried feet descending and the echo in my mind of his words, "Come and you will see." So I gripped the cold handrail like a blind man and began my descent, inching ever forward. Ever downward, ever forward, ever downward, ever forward, ever downward. And I tried to count my steps, but I lost track. How many floors did we descend? I didn't know. I couldn't see. All I could do was listen to the tapping. But the tapping grew softer and softer and softer. And everything was dark and quiet. I didn't have the courage to cry out for help, but I remembered that whispered warning, "Tremble, all who enter here." And I trembled as those words lingered in the air. And again, I realized I was alone. But then I heard a woman's voice gently push aside the silence. She said, "Aren't you a poet?" And the darkness hid my shame. And I wondered how she knew me, but she asked me again with this simmering joy, "Aren't you the poet?" And timidly, I spoke. I said, I used to write poetry, but that was long ago. Then she asked me a third time, "Aren't you the poet who lives in the woods?" The burning zeal in her voice sparked this fire in me, and suddenly the darkness that obscured this old, old desire in me faltered. And I remembered, yes, well, I want to be a poet. "Good," she said, and then more softly, "Tell me, young poet, why do you hide from pain? Why do you shut your eyes to grief? Why do you shut your ears? What are you afraid to see? What are you afraid to hear?" "I'm not afraid of pain or grief," I said. "You don't know me." She chuckled and said, "Aren't you the poet and the preacher?" I said, well, yeah. And she said, aren't you the poet who shares the gospel in verse? I said, well, yeah. And she said, aren't you the preacher who loves poetic words? I said, yeah. And then she looked at me and said, but you don't like to listen. You just want to be heard. Her accusation stunned me into silence. The light in my imagination faded, and I remembered that I could not see. Words, words, words. I love poetic words, but I didn't want to listen. I just wanted to be heard. The accusing voice was right. I had said that so many times before, believing I was justified. Why should I listen to others vent their anguish? And why should I complain about injustice in this world when Jesus is my portion? Isn't it enough for me to boldly stand and declare that Jesus died and Jesus rose and he is coming back again? Why should I linger in the grip of misery? And then the woman's voice returned. She said, the poet and the preacher both must testify. She said, you must be a witness when others shut their eyes. You must carry what you see like a precious testimony of life as lived. And then, watered by your tears, and warmed by your compassion, the seeds of hope can sprout or desperation reigns. Her words began to stir in me, and then she said, our God is not afraid of our lament. Why are you? And again, the darkness and my mind began to falter, and a grain of light began to vibrate, and it hummed, and the woman's voice said, listen. And I listened. The humming was sonorous and mournful and deep. Slowly it rose to an aching groan, and then I heard a new voice, bearing a sorrow, ancient and lonely. Down from below me, it assaulted heaven.
Why does God bother giving light to the miserable? Why bother keeping bitter people alive? Those who want in the worst way to die and can't, who can't imagine anything better than death, who count the day of their death and burial the happiest day of their life. What's the point of life when it doesn't make sense? When God blocks all roads to meaning. Instead of bread, I get groans for my supper, then leave the table and vomit my anguish. The worst of my fears has come true. What I have dreaded most has happened. My repose is shattered, my peace destroyed. No rest for me, ever. Death has invaded my life.
I didn't have the right words, any words, those words of anguish tore through my thoughts and left them shredded and strewn. I knew those words, the words of righteous Job, but I had no words to answer his complaint. So I waited in the darkness, in the silence, until the woman's voice returned. She said, "Our God is not afraid of our lament. He does not hide from pain. And you must be a witness even in affliction." And then my voice came back to me, and timidly I spoke. "But the gospel, it speaks of hope. Where's the hope in words like those?" The woman's voice was kind as she answered. She said, "Young poet, the hope is not in the words. It's in the voice. Because the one who cries out to God in the midst of bitter pain is expecting God to listen and to answer." She said, "Words, words, words. You dislike bitter words, but it's cruel to shut your ears and leave suffering unheard." She said, "You must be a witness when others shut their ears. You must carry what you hear like a precious testimony of life as lived, and then nourished in the soil of celebration and affliction. Your words will stretch out sturdy roots, and tightly gripping earth will have the strength to grasp the listening skies." And then she said, "Don't you want to be a poet? Then be a witness." As the echo of her voice faded, the darkness all around me cracked. A seam of light opened in the middle of the ceiling, and the room was suffused with a soft amber glow. And just below, in the center of the room, I saw a table with a wooden cup and a broken loaf of bread. And right next to them, a leather-bound book was lying open. And as I approached, I heard another voice say these words:
"The Master Jesus, on the night of his betrayal, took bread, and having given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, broken for you. Do this to remember me.' After supper, he did the same thing with the cup. 'This cup is my blood, my new covenant with you. Each time you drink this cup, remember me.' What you must solemnly realize is that every time you eat this bread and every time you drink this cup, you reenact your words and actions, the death of the Master. You will be drawn back to this meal again and again, until the Master returns."
When the voice departed, The professor with the glasses stepped out from the shadows, and his eyes were bright, but solemn. He looked at me and said, "Our God is not afraid of our lament. But what about you?" "I don't know," I answered. "I want to be a witness, but I don't know." And then he looked at me and said, "But aren't you a poet?" And when I hesitated, he asked me again. He said, "Aren't you a poet?" And I looked at him in the eye and said, "Yes, yes, I am." And he said, "Then you must be a witness when others shut their eyes and when others shut their ears. Yes, it's true that Jesus died and Jesus rose and Jesus will return. But look at the bread and the wine. And remember, some bodies are still being broken. Some blood is still being shed. Some wounds are still being opened. And some souls still tremble with dread. And what hope can you offer them unless, like Christ, you come and bear their burdens?" He said, "Be a witness to their testimony. Listen to their pain. Right now, listen." But I protested, "Right now? Who am I supposed to listen to? No one else is here." The professor shook his head and said, "No one else is here? What about the young woman in the shadows, the one you never noticed?" I opened my mouth, but before I could speak, he said, "Listen first. Listen." And the woman stepped forward, and I listened.
"Dear God, please keep me off people's hearts and my name out of your mouth. I can't fix it. You won't fix it. It's worthless. I'm worthless. My Midas touch is death, and I poison everything I build. My best thoughts come on sleepless nights, insomnia on my brain, and inspiration on my breath. I craft sculpture out of words, but your words are useless. All you do is say my name. You say it over and over and over. I want to be called something else. Dear God, this isn't working out. It's not you, it's me. You're perfect, and I'm still trying to figure it out. I can't drag you down with me, and I'm just going to taint everything you love. Maybe someday, but not today. So I'll just see you around. Dear God, it's been weeks, and I've been thinking about you. Look, can we just get together and talk? I'll meet you at the altar around 7. We can sing and maybe even pray a little bit. I just want to see how you're doing. Dear God, I know I messed up, but nothing has been the same without you. I can't eat, I can't sleep, so I've just been writing. All I pin down is about you, for you, to you, so I might as well talk. I got all this shame and fear and guilt. I told you I was broken. Why won't you believe me? Why can't you just let me go? Don't you know you're better off without me?"
Her words reverberated deep in my soul, and the professor's words mingled. And neither voice would let me go. I was beginning to listen and remember and understand that some bodies are still being broken. And some blood is still being shed. And some wounds are still being opened. And some souls still tremble with dread. And what hope can I offer them unless, like Christ, I come and bear their burdens? Yes, I'll be a witness when others shut their eyes and when others shut their ears. I was fighting back the young woman's tears in my own eyes. I blinked, and when I opened them, I was back outside again. The great green lawn stretched before me, bathed in twilight's glow, and a gentle rain was falling from the sky. I looked and saw the statue of the kneeling, weeping God. And I imagined that if I listened hard enough that he might speak, so I waited for the voice patiently. But no one spoke. Instead, a single solemn note, a song, came floating on the breeze.
Come and weave with me just a little while, just a little while. Come and weave a little while, oh, with me. For my soul is too weary, I can't carry on all alone. Come and weep, oh, a little while with me. Come and pray with me just a little while. Just a little while, come and pray a little while with me. Won't you come help me lift up my burdens to my God? Come and pray just a little while with me.
Come and sing with me just a little while, just a little while. Come and sing a little while with me. For my load is too heavy, I can't carry it on my own. Come and sing just a little while with me. Mm-hmm. 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 face of the newly weeping God. And I remembered my question. What would make you cry? What would make you cry? The last rays of twilight sank and gave their place to night. And I confessed, yes, I'll be a witness. Yes, I'll come and weep. So I kneeled beside the statue of the kneeling, weeping God. And I trembled. Thank you.
God is not afraid of our lament.
But what about us?
The beginning of despair and lament is the same. They both arrive out of an experience of helplessness. They both recognize our complete inability to fix the problem, to save ourselves. But the ends of lament and despair are very different. Despair cries out to a void, but lament is situated in a larger story. Both lament and despair begin with a feeling of utter aloneness. No one can understand this particular pain. Despair is doomed to remain in that aloneness. But lament has known a larger story. Lament has experienced a God who comes to where we are, a God who has experienced our pain, a God who refuses to ever let us be alone. Our presence to one another, our ability to truly hear one another, our sitting in community with the pain of one another is what allows despair to be transformed into lament on its way to resurrection. You must be a witness when others shut their eyes and when others shut their ears. It's true that Jesus died and rose, and Jesus will return. But look at the bread and the wine. And remember, some bodies are still being broken. Some blood is still being shed. Some wounds are still being opened. And some lives still tremble with dread. And what hope can you offer unless, like Christ, you come and bear their burdens? Be a witness. Let us pray. God who listens, God who condescends, forgive us for not hearing one another. We have protected ourselves from the loneliness of despair by refusing to be vulnerable. For some, this refusal is a protection of our status. For others, our refusal to be vulnerable is a matter of survival. Teach us, O God, to listen. May we become a people who are present to one another, even
and especially in our pain, so that those who protect themselves from vulnerability will feel no such need. May we be a people who know how to lament together and so become known by our love for one another. In the name of the one who came to us and bears our burdens. Amen.